So again, I want to come back to this issue of cultivating a new kind of consciousness, discovering a new kind of consciousness. In a way, that's the whole point. I just realised that the lights on the Buddha aren't on, and that feels somehow wrong. Thank you. I'm wondering about these sometimes. That's better, isn't it? Anyway, I thought something was wrong. So we're trying to discover a new consciousness. That's the whole point. And that consciousness that we're trying to discover is a consciousness that constantly unfolds. And what this image, that must be why I wanted to light it up, what this image represents is not a fixed point of perfection, which tends to be a theological idea, a religious idea, a fixed point of perfection, usually which you can never get anywhere near, and which you're not fit enough to gather up the crumbs under thy table. So it doesn't represent that. It represents a state of constantly unfolding creative consciousness, without any hint of reaction, without any hint of a concern with self, putting self at the centre of the universe. In a way, it's an image for life fully experienced and responded to without a me in the middle of it trying to control it all. Yeah? That's what that image represents. It's golden because, and it looks, it's in this sort of setting, this religious setting, because that kind of consciousness is above and beyond our ordinary human consciousness. We can experience it from time to time, and little glimpses of it, and those glimpses are a glimpse of our potential. They're not mistaken, the glimpses. You can mistake how you understand them and all sorts of things, but the glimpses aren't mistakes. Yeah? What tends to happen is we get stuck in divided consciousness. That's how you could call our ordinary day-to-day consciousness, is divided consciousness. Yeah? We're divided, aren't we? We're divided up. We're divided often against ourselves. So in my group, the group I was listening in on, some people were saying how, you know, they were quickly criticising themselves or, you know, trying to work too hard at mindfulness. So you can be divided against yourself, more or less consciously. You can be divided in the sense that your thoughts are thinking one thing and your feelings are doing another. So you think, I must get up in the morning to meditate. Or you think, this is really what I need. Someone in my group was saying, this is really what I need. This is really what I need. I've got the cushions. I've got the kit. I don't seem to have done it, anything. Yeah. You see, that's a divided consciousness. That you know that something's valuable, but obviously you don't feel that because you don't act on it. So if you're noticing things like that in your home practice, you're noticing disintegration. Yeah. So the first part, if you are noticing something like that, I want to do it, I'm not doing it, start to try to feel that tension a bit more. Start to tune into that experience. Why don't you do the things that you know you need to do? What's going on? And you try to ask that question not in an analytical, critical way, but in an interested way. What is it? What goes on? Why don't you do the things that you know to be in your own interest? So do you see that our usual consciousness is divided? And as I was saying in the tea break, in the announcements there, it's divided in itself by prapunkcha. Prapunkcha is both a symptom of disintegration and a cause of it. So that the more we allow our mind to run unchecked through our habitual stories, narratives, patterns, assumptions, and so on, we separate into a delta of cells that are often in conflict with each other. Yeah? We get stuck in divided consciousness. And we can forget that there is another kind of consciousness. I think it's quite possible to forget that it's better to be happy, for instance. It's quite easy to remember that you want to be right, but quite easy to forget that you actually it might be better to be happy. Being right can become almost addictive in itself, can you? You don't mind being unhappy as long as you're right. So on your gravestone it says, "I was right." They were wrong. And of course, essentially you're divided, we're divided against others and against the world. And of course we're in a world increasingly divided. I mean, that's the thing I keep on noticing, is a world that's increasingly and almost impossibly divided. So we're living off organic veg and croissants. Meanwhile, people exactly like us are having to walk across a country and get a raft to try and escape another country. I mean, that is a level of division that seems to me utterly unsustainable and ignoble for us not to try to respond to. How we respond to it, though, I believe, is that we need to become part of the solution, not just more dividing inside ourselves and around each other. So we get stuck in divided consciousness. So do you see that the first thing we're trying to do in mindfulness is become whole? Often the way you start that is that you notice that you're not. And you notice that with this kind of friendly, curious thing. It's better, I think, not to have any kind of moralistic approach to yourself. That you notice your mind with a sort of benign, bemused interest than stuff and nonsense that you think. I say you, I mean me, but I also mean you. You notice that with benign, amused interest, like an indulgent parent would notice it. Yeah. So I've been using this metaphor that, we have a consciousness that's different from a child's consciousness, but we can't explain it to a child. And I was remembering that wonderful film, Boyhood. I don't know if you saw it, which I watched it twice, and I enjoyed it better the second time, partly because I wasn't so worried about what was going to happen to him. That was striking, wasn't it, in the film itself? Because you'd seen him grow up, it wasn't actors doing him, you'd seen him, someone grow up. When things might have happened to him, it really worried you. There's this bit where they throw this awful machine, this sort of saw blade, and you just think, oh no, and he's only like 15 at the time, oh no, what's going to happen to him? It's because you've actually seen someone grow up. And I remember there's a moment, isn't there, in the car there, him and his sister's about a little bit older, and they're fighting in the car. And the mother says, put the wall, they've got this cushion between them, put the wall between you again, and she's trying to drive. And I remember that with my sister, we had this thing where, I don't know where I'm going with this, but hang on for a minute. We will get somewhere. We had this, people like anecdotes. We had this thing where we shared a bedroom, and, there's always an argument about whose side of the bedroom was whose. It was like a major ongoing war of attrition, which my sister managed to wage just as ferociously as I did. So eventually we drew a line. We drew this line, and then we'd go to bed in our bunk bed, and the light would be on. And then there would ensue a great big argument about which side of the room the light was on. It was on the other side of the room. But this, that's not fair, We had all these arguments about that sort of thing, and that's what you do as a child, isn't it? And you see, as an adult, hopefully, to the degree we really are an adult, and that's up for question sometimes, hopefully, you see how petty that is, don't you? You see that you've got into this divided state, or you've got things that have become really important to you that actually aren't important, and often you make a big deal of it. I remember I made a real big deal about not getting a book I wanted, and making a complete deal of that. As an adult, you know that it's because you've got a child's consciousness, and those sort of things are very important to you. And you see that what I'm trying to say is there's consciousnesses above ours now which would think exactly the same of us, that we're falling out with ourselves and other people over trivialities, over pettiness. We've misperceived things, just as a child would. So we've got a cushion between us and our partner, or us and our sister, or us and our work colleagues, or whatever. So the first thing we're trying to do is discover a unified consciousness. And that the primary way of doing that is by becoming aware. And that's a big thing in itself. Noticing the kind of stories that you tell yourself, which, remember, are automatic stories, and they'll be going on just below the level of awareness, so you often won't notice them. So recently I've been teaching lawyers, I've been going into these lawyers' offices, and one of the things I was saying to them is, you see that probably what will be happening for you is you'll have a search and destroy mode of thinking. It's quite a common mental style where you just calculate what's the problem, let me sort it out. Can be helpful. You can get things done in that way. Often becomes hidebound, and before you know it, you don't notice opportunities because of imagined threats, because you're in that search and destroy mode. And that search and destroy mode becomes habitualized and automatic, so you don't notice you're doing it, and then it spreads into the rest of your life. So you know, when you really don't need it, when you're relaxing and trying to do nothing, when you've got a time to rest, you've still got this search and destroy mode, because that will become your automatic setting. Your mind runs in the patterns that your mind is running. That is like basic Buddhism, yeah? That your mind runs in the patterns that your mind has run in. You'll think the thought of things that you've thought often in the past, and those things will have become habitual and automatic, and very often you won't notice them. In the book, that's why I say why it's important, and I emphasise this more as we go on, that you need friends. Because even though you don't notice them, quite often your friends will. They'll say, if they're genuine friends, and if you are genuinely open to them, they'll say, this is you doing that thing that you do. Yeah. This is you being pessimistic. This is you being anxious. I was telling a friend of mine just the other day, I said, you're very anxious. You're a very anxious man. He said, am I? It's just, for me, it's just the water I swim in. I've met his mother. She's very, very anxious. So if you've been brought up in a world where there's a lot of anxiety, you sort of don't notice it. It's just life. You know, when you're a child, you don't think, gosh, there's an awful lot of anxious people around. What's going on? You know, usually you just copy anxiety. You see what I mean? And you don't notice that, yeah? And you see how we reinforce things for each other in that way. Like, one of the interesting things with lawyers is that they think it attracts pessimists. Because, you know, pessimism is problematic in life. It's mostly genetic, they think now. But being a pessimist is helpful for being a lawyer, because it helps you see what could go wrong when other people wouldn't. But then before you know it, you're surrounded by other people who are really good at seeing what could go wrong. And you see how that then spreads into the rest of your life. Yeah. So not only does our mindset become automatic, we tend to meet up with people who've got the similar sort of automatic mindsets that we have, lawyers being an example. So the first thing we try to do is gather ourselves. The primary practice of doing that is mindfulness. Mindfulness is a practice of starting again. Mindfulness is a practice of doing your mindful walk, stepping out of prapuncha. Somebody in my group, this is the group I was listening in on, was saying it's really helpful just to have a name for it. That YouTube channel of your mind is prapuncha, where you have a playlist that you keep going trolling through. That's your prapuncha, trying to step out of that kind of mind. Repetitive, automatic, driven, unaware thinking. So the first practice is to keep stepping out of that into direct experience. Already you're probably finding that easy enough to do, difficult to remember to do. So we're going to be suggesting that you carry on with your mindful walk, and do this practice of falling through the holes of your day. I've been doing that more, just disappearing into the holes of my day. I don't need to still stay in that pod of thought. I can drop out of that into, here I am, here's the world. I'm travelling a lot at the moment, launching this book. And, you know, if you're not careful, you're always on the way there or back or thinking about going. But actually, as I'm going to the station, my body will do that without me thinking about it. It's amazing how much, you know, your body will do your swipe, your Oyster card. You don't need to think about it. You can just, like, ride in the body of your awareness and just notice stuff and just drop out of being a particular person. That's what I've been doing more, anyway. It can become even slightly spooky. You just think, you know, ooh. It's like that, yeah. That was eloquent enough, wasn't it? And then I've been suggesting you do these breathing spaces. Really, really useful. You can sort of rebel against it. Sometimes it feels like the last thing you want to do, but it can really give you another perspective. You just stop. You see how you're doing just now. You gather your awareness. You then just take a few breaths. Then you let your feelings in the body just be there. You do 3 a day, you do 6 a day. I'll come back onto that in the end. Just as a little addition to that, start to notice whether you're doing it in a goal-orientated way. So start to know, thinking, okay, I'll do that thing, and then this panicky feeling or this overwhelmed feeling or this overexcitable feeling will go away. Or if I do that, I'll get that nice feeling I got yesterday. Those are things that easily happen to us when you try to practice. When you do that, you start to tighten up immediately because it's become a goal. And if you don't relax when this happens, then you think it's not working or I can't do it. So instead of getting into that, when you notice yourself getting into a goal about I'm going to do this because this will result from it, all you're doing there is tightening up. So start to notice, okay, I'm just tightening up here. I don't need to get into all that. I'm just going to do the practice, but I don't want to tighten up. So even consciously notice tightening up. If you're subtle, you can even notice that you're sort of psychically tightening up, just as much as physically. But usually it's easier to notice in your body. So that's the ground of this journey that we're on. And it's a ground that we need to keep on re-establishing. We win that ground, we lose it again. We lose it again, we lose it again. So mindfulness is a practice of starting again. And one of the things I want to really recommend is you keep playing with how does it work? How are you going to do that? Keep playing with it. You know what you're trying to do. You're trying to step acupuncture into body sensation. You're trying to take ownership of your life. Feel what's going on. Take ownership of your agency and so on that I've written about in the book. Work out ways of doing it. Do what I suggest, and if you find other ways, find those ways. Yeah? Start to learn already. Like somebody was saying, gosh, I found the whole thing really helpful. So, okay, let's just do that for a bit. That might be helpful for a bit, and then it'll stop being helpful. So, okay, we need to change the metaphor now and do the mindful walk. We need to go back onto meditation now. Yeah? So keep on finding out what's working. I have to teach you. Sukhasiddhi has to teach the whole of you. And you're always generalising, inevitably, and what's true for one person is not true for another. Yeah. So you need to discover how to do this. Learn the principles and keep on discovering how to apply them. But now we come on to the second phase, the second great phase of this journey, which is rather uncomfortably called positive emotion. The better way of calling it is kusala karma, but I'll come on to that in a second. In the book I say, I'm not very happy with positive, it sounds too cheery. People say, why don't you just be positive? And I don't like emotional, it sounds too emotional. Yeah? So what it really means, this next stage, is to see that on the basis of awareness, on the basis of collecting yourself again and again, stepping out of divided consciousness, cultivating unified consciousness, you know, including experiencing things that are uncomfortable, experiencing things that drives and so on. On that basis, you start to act in ways which flourish your life and flourish the lives of those around you. Mindfulness is not enough. There's a bit of a trend in mindfulness at the moment, which is great, but it's not enough. It's not a path in itself. It's an intrinsic and vital part of the path, but it's not enough. It's where we keep coming back to this unified consciousness, but then we need to start thinking, okay, I need to start to fashion my life in a way in which my consciousness arises in a deeper, richer, happier, more connecting, more creative kind of way. So a Sanskrit term. Is it Sanskrit? I don't know. You won't know. It might be Sanskrit or Pali. I'm not very good on that sort of thing. Anyway, a Buddhist term is kusala karma. So kusala just means sort of good, helpful, productive, fruitful. Karma just means action. So this is a stage of good, helpful, useful, productive karma. What do you need to do to fashion your consciousness in another way? Yeah. This arises out of a fundamental principle of human consciousness, which is that what you attend to is what you become. What you attend to is what you become. So a very simple example, if you go shopping, I had to go and buy a suit today, which was the most stressful experience of the day. Anyway, luckily, Canute saved me from my own agonies. God dear. Anyway, won't go to that. But if you go shopping, and you go from one shop to another, and everyone's very helpful, and then the last shop you go to, the shop assistant is rude and doesn't look at you when she or he gives you the change, the experience that will show up most to you is that last person. Yeah. So we're evolutionarily, however you say that, evolutionarily, designed to know, particularly be sensitive to threat. You know, our archaic prehistory is to do with survival. So our brains are tuned to notice things that will threaten us. So anything that feels threatening will show up to you very much, including potential threats. I notice this when I'm cycling. There's so many potential threats. You get in a really bad mood, can't you, cycling? Because your brain is highly tuned to threat. That's why people lose it driving so much. So your brain is tuned to things that threaten you. So if you've done that shopping, the person that was rude to you, you'll remember that. Not only will you remember that, you'll talk about it. You'll get back and say, you won't believe what happened. And you'll tell that story. You won't tell the story about number one, number two, number three, number four. You'll tell the story about the last one. Yeah? So what that means is that we need to quite consciously and deliberately in this second stage cultivate those experiences that we won't notice so much for evolutionary reasons because they're not threatening us. So, in the book I'm saying, if you're a woman, you're married, you'll notice your husband's not helping very much with the children, but you won't notice very much they're working on horrible hours to pay for their schooling. We tend to notice the bit that threatens us. We don't notice the what we're given. You could go on with example after example. So this stage of kusala karma starts, I think, with trying to consciously draw forward the positive. Yeah. I say a lot about it in this chapter. So once again, as I've said, that part of this course is a sort of study aspect. So do make sure you read the chapter this week. Because there's too much for me to try and say, and I want to make sure there's enough experience of it. So the main things I want to recommend is that you, for the next 2 weeks, that you, every night before you go to bed, you write down 5 things that you've experienced that day that you feel grateful for. Grateful for, enjoyed, valued, something like that. If you can, see if you can write that down for this whole second stage. So we might do it in a minute, but anyway, start. What today do you feel grateful for? Try and write down 5 things. They've even done research on this, where they did this research thing with two weeks like this. They got some people to write 5 things they were grateful for, people to write 5 hassles they'd had that day, something people to write just 5 things they remember that day. At the end of the 2 weeks, people who wrote about what they were grateful for were shown to be considerably happier. You start, as soon as you start to do it, you start to notice it more. Because you become what you give attention to, if you start to notice things that you're grateful for, actually what you'll find is you'll start to notice it happening more. And then you'll start to feel gratitude more. Yeah? So see if you can do that, if you can. And do something generous every day that you wouldn't normally do. Could be a small thing. It doesn't have to be anything big, but just try every day. You know, you could do this instead. What I'm wanting to do with all this home practice is give you choices, but I want you to decide tonight what you're going to do. So you could either alternatively just think, okay, I'm going to note down every day, I'm going to do something generous that I wouldn't normally do. Usually best to start close at home or close at work. The trouble is, because you don't normally do it, you don't notice that somebody else is doing it. That you don't notice in the office that somebody always gets the milk, it's not me. I actually once, about 3 years after I moved into the community, I was harumphing because I was always the one to get the milk. And then we were clearing up the community and someone said, "Where's the Hoover?" I didn't know. So that alerted me to the fact that I hadn't actually Hoovered for 3 years. So when I was really noticing that I'm always the one who gets the milk, I can't believe I have to go get the milk again. You know, being that there wasn't 3 years worth of dust, somebody else was hoovering. Yeah. So it's actually weirdly difficult to notice that actually people are doing stuff for you. Actually, all the time, people are doing stuff for you and have done all your life. Otherwise, you would not have survived. So see if you can do something generous. It can be a tiny thing, but something that you wouldn't normally have done. And try and do it every day for 2 weeks, not just for 1 week, folks, but for 2 weeks. Yeah. So you might want to choose one of those or the other of those. I still want you to be doing either the mindful walk or the holes practice and the breathing space. Again, tonight I want you to come up with what can I actually do? And remember, what we're trying to do, which is my new rule of thumb, is think what you can do and then do a bit less. But decide that tonight. You know, I can do the generosity and this, and so I'll just do this and this. Yeah. And the other thing that I want to start introducing now is meditation. So from this week, every week on the course, in the book, there's a guide to meditation. And I'm keeping it really simple. I'm saying, let's start it really slowly. Let's just do this week. And all I'm suggesting for this next week is that you work on prapuncture, like Sukhasiddhi was saying. You notice prapuncture. You do it however long you've got. Half an hour is great. 15 minutes is fine if that's all you've got. And all you're going to do is notice yourself in prapuncture, step out of it, step into the breath, breathe a bit, you go off, you notice it, you're going to train in that. And you're going to try and train in not taking your prapuncture personally. So if it's, you know, rage or lust or worrying or aggressive thoughts or enjoying the pain of others, you know, all sorts of things that we can sneakily get into in the privacy of our mind. Just try and notice it, but don't take it personally. It's not you. It's not who you are. You get inveigled into that very easily. One of the things you're trying to develop in mindfulness is to notice that you just get drawn into the perspective of your prapuncture. So if your prapuncture is worrying, you just get drawn into seeing the world from a worrying point of view. Yeah? It's not really you. It's not who you are. It's not what you mean to do with your life. You don't need to take it personally. And that's a practice in itself. You notice your mind going off into all kinds of stuff. And that's just your mind going off into all sorts. It's not a personal thing. And then you just step out of that, whatever it is, however bad or good you think it is, into more direct experience. Yeah? But then this week, we're starting to create a new mind. And that new mind is what we've already started to do is create a more whole mind. Now what we're trying to do is, on the basis of that awareness and wholeness, we're trying to flourish our mind more, we're trying to grow our mind more, which means me relating to you in a more generous way. It means me giving, it means me remembering to be grateful. we're trying to practice this second stage of kusala karma, useful, beneficial activity. That's another way I think I've translated it in the book. Beneficial activity. Beneficial in terms of helping you gain enlightenment, helping you discover a new kind of consciousness. Any quick questions about that before I break us up into groups? I don't know whether I've... Yeah.
If you had that negative experience with the shopkeeper in the middle, you know, the negative experience with the shopkeeper?
Oh, yes.
If you had that in the middle, would that have changed things rather than at the end of the
day? It would. Apparently, you're more likely to remember things at the end. You'd still tend to focus on that because you're focused on difficulty. But what psychologists, having sort of studied, is that the ends of things are very important. How you finish things is important because it affects how you remember the whole thing, apparently. So it's interesting. You need to pay attention to endings. Ends of days, ends of holidays, ends of here. We need to learn to finish things well, which includes things like finishing your cycles. You know, like if you've just eaten your cereal, you just don't stand up and leave it on. You finish things. It creates a different sense of what the thing you've just done feels like if you end well.
You're talking about like the different kinds of worry and how to not take it personal.
Yeah.
But when you do worry or whatever the thing is, you get caught up in it. The bigger the worry, the more sort of personal.
It feels, yeah. It does feel very personal. So what I mean is that you can get in a storm of worry, can't you? I was really struck in that line in Macbeth in the film where he says, "My mind is full of scorpions." I can't quite remember the actual line, but you know, the reason they've kept that line, it's a wonderful line, but the reason they've kept that line is because we can all immediately relate to that. Now, we haven't just killed an elderly king and are about to kill a whole family, but our mind can be full of scorpions. So what we're trying to do, noticing that propunctua, which is a story about that, not taking it personally, is just saying, let me just feel this feeling of worry. Let me just try and be with that. What that can do is give you new purchase on it, but you don't want to do it for that reason. So that's what not taking it personally means. It's stepping into the direct feeling of it, what's called the Vedana of it. I haven't got time to go into that, it's in the book. The texture of that worry experience, not the narrative of it, but what does it feel like to be worried? So that the propunctua is just like the wind, and you're just trying to feel what the wind feels like on you rather than be blown along with it. Yeah, that's what I mean by not taking it personally.
I'm looking at wanting to try and do that, so I was in a difficult space, and I'm trying to sit with it.
Yeah.
But I noticed as I was doing that, it became more dark and just more of a threat.
Yeah,
so I had an instinct to stop it because it was getting dangerous.
Yes, yes, yeah.
So what in that situation when it does feel instinctively too much?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you sit with it, or do you? How far do you push, or can it be unhealthy sometimes?
Yes, it can be. Yes, I mean, there's two things I want to say. When you notice things. Another one is hankering, when you're really hankering something. Say you've got a really hot date. I mean, I'm sure you all have. At the end of this class, you know, you can be really hankering after something. And if you were to close your eyes and feel that just now, it would actually get more intense. It can get more intense, and then it'll quieten down. So it can be that. Sometimes you just need to sit with it. And you really need to keep softening your face, softening your shoulders, softening your belly. Let me just feel it. You can even say to yourself, whatever it is, let me just feel it, it's all right. It'll get more intense because you are turning towards it and feeling it. And then if you're doing that genuinely mindfully, and I'll come back to not doing it like that, that intensity will then quieten down naturally. It'll be felt, it'll be unpleasant, and then it's got its own natural history, it'll quieten down. Now sometimes... this is why it's so important for you to play with all this. Sometimes that's not what's happening. Actually, your mindfulness isn't strong enough and you're just feeding it. So you sit there and think, oh gosh, I feel really, it's a horrible feeling. Gosh, it is horrible. It's really, really horrible. You know, your so-called mindfulness is slipping into the thing itself. It's slipping into the state. Do you see what I mean? And then that will make it worse. Because what you're doing then is adding to it, putting out the fire with gasoline, as Iggy Pop said. that's my contemporary reference. It's like donkeys and yokes. You might as well stick to Bach. It's David Bowie, yeah. It was Iggy Pop first. Anyway, so when you're like that, if it's like that, if you think, actually, tell you what, I don't think I can do this now, then you need to move to this stage, which is, how about I do something useful instead? So I can't do this now. What I could do, though, is I could go and wash up all that stuff on my, that I've left and I can't face. I can do that with this energy. I can do that. Or actually, what I'm going to do is go for a run, because I can't do anything with this energy just now. Sometimes what you need to make is make this choice into moving into this state. Actually, I need to do something useful with this. I can't do this mindfulness thing at the moment. I'm actually making it worse. I notice this with myself when I'm tired and I'm trying to think about something. Sometimes you think, I cannot think about this now. I'm not up to it now. Or even, you know, you try and be mindful that you're worried, and then you just find that yourself you're getting more worried. So now you need to actually move on to this stage and do something useful, fruitful, connecting, something with that energy. Yeah, you'll need to discover which one you're going to do. There's no rule of thumb. And I sometimes don't know in the moment which to do.
Yes. Like I shut my mind off and then I'm solely breathing and breathing in more.
Yeah. So like, don't do that.
Am I cheating?
Yeah, don't do that. Bad choice. I mean, lots of people do it. They just think, and I can understand that, you know, for heaven's sake, can everybody be quiet? Almost inevitably, it doesn't work. It would be better to think, okay, I'm in that place where I just think I can't stand this. So what you'll be doing again is you'll be tensing up. So instead of saying shut up, just say, let's see if I can, what's happening in my face, what's happening in my belly. I'm getting really wound up now. It's interesting how much we use that metaphor, because it's very descriptive of what happens. You sort of wound yourself up. So saying shut up will just make it worse. You usually get what's called an ironic response, where you can do it for a while, you can force it. It's not very healthy, I don't think. One more, any other quick question for somebody else, and then we'll...
I don't know, I'm just thinking, is it not just about the acknowledgement of the fault, of what you're having it, and just seeing it just for what it is?
Yes, if it's that's fine.
Obviously, there's always going to be emotional attachments. It's stuff that I've worked through myself, personally. And what I found helpful is, we may have might be 10 people that said we look good today and another person that said we're tired, and we kind of think, did I look tired? And kind of start anchoring on to that thought, that ending, I suppose, what you're talking about. And then it was just something that someone had said.
Yeah.
But it brought up certain other feelings where I might have felt low about myself, or I might have felt uneasy about myself. So I feel the uneasy feeling, but I think then I say to myself, is that this isn't way back then, this is in my present.
Yeah. So what you can do is say, this is a thought.
Yeah,
I've got.
This is just a thought.
It's a thought, it's not a fact.
And it kind of disappears. Yeah. Almost like the power of it.
Yeah, so that's fine.
Yeah.
But you just see how you need to play with it. That might be fine. It might then gradually become something more like that's being said over here. Work out, you have to keep on looking to see what's working. If you're saying, oh, that's just a thought. If things quieten down a bit, then that's great. If things lock up, then that's not so good. Yeah,
so you're saying staying with it will deepen the awareness.
Yes, that's right. Staying with the feeling of that uncomfortable feeling that someone says you look tired makes you feel uncomfortable. Try and just stay with that. Mm. Yeah, not try to solve it.
Mm.
And part of that can be, that's just a thought, but let me just still feel that it makes me feel uncomfortable, or I feel uncomfortable in response to it. Easy to say, not always easy to do. And it can feel counterintuitive. One of the reasons we think so much is to get away from discomfort. We think if I can think my way out of it, I won't have this discomfort. Actually, that is part of the problem, even becomes a major part of the problem. Okay, so what I want to do now, I don't want to get us too discursive, is if you can go into twos or threes again. So here's what I want, you've got this, the generosity, the gratitude list every night. What can you do, what are you going to do to flourish your mind in the second stage? What can you carry on doing from the first stage? Because we don't leave the stages behind. The mindful walk, the holes practice. And can you start meditating this week? Okay? And try and decide now what you're going to do. And if it's a lot, do a little bit less. Decide to do a little bit less. And if you've been noticing already, actually last week I thought I could do three things, I didn't even do one. Try and do one this week, but really try and do it. Yeah?